Ah, just like I thought. He came up the Gulf Stream from southern waters.
We're taking a deep dive into the waters off Amity Island on Real Lit.
Welcome to the inaugural edition of Real Lit. I'm Steven.
And I'm Mackenzie. Thank you all for joining us on this new endeavor we're embarking on. Perhaps it's not as treacherous as a trip with Quint on the Orca, but we are in uncharted waters for my colleague and I.
So shall we just really quickly talk about how this idea came about?
Absolutely. Yeah, we just really love film, we love literature, we love talking about it, and so we thought you should really hear what we have to say.
Exactly, we're brilliant. Also, of course, we co-taught Jaws at one point, so it was a natural starting point, very popular film, very different from the book in a lot of ways. So,
yes, different for students as well to read a novel, especially one that's a little bit more secular and action-packed, and the students really seem to enjoy it a lot. That's really what we love this podcast for, sharing our thoughts and ideas with you guys as well.
All right, so shall we begin talking a little bit about the book and the film? This is, again, one of the reasons we chose Jaws, right? People sometimes ask us, no, by the way, I know the typical response you expect from a college lecturer like us. Is the book or the film better? The answer is the book, always, right? We're not really going to address it in that sense, right? We're just going to show a little bit of love to both. It's interesting, though, with Jaws. If you ask me which is better, the book or the film, my response is yes, because in a lot of ways, they're two different stories. The first two acts are very close, I guess, but the third act just diverges in wild ways. And that's not even mentioning, by the way, spoiler alerts, the mafia or Ellen having an affair with Hooper. Lots of stuff going on in that book that we don't see, fortunately, I would say, in the film itself.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very hard to almost think of them as the same thing because they're so different in these major plot devices. And like in the book, it goes so deep into each character and yes, the mafia and the affair and all of these very taboo things that are super interesting about the book. But then when you watch the film, it's a little bit more family friendly in the sense of its surface level in the interactions. We don't get that inner monologue that we get in the book. And so I watched the movie first before I even thought to read the book. And I love the film. And then I read the book and I love the novel.
Yeah, you say family friendly. It is worth pointing out there was only PG and R at the time this came out. And there are some moments, particularly the violence, that I'm sure traumatized some young children. Ben Gardner's head, right? Funny, our local theater just showed this on the big screen, and we went to see it along with a colleague of ours who's kind of a scaredy cat. She doesn't really care for horror films, and she's seen it 100 times, of course. And I could see her tensing at that moment, just tensing and tensing. And then she screamed when we see Ben Gardner's head. And I'm like, you knew it was coming. And she's like, I don't care. It was terrifying. So, yeah, this kind of started the conversation that, interestingly enough, later would end with Raiders of the Lost Ark, if you've seen that in the face-melting scene. Mm-hmm. That was the point where the MPAA, Motion Picture Association, decided we need something in between PG and R. Thus, we got the PG-13. So Jaws didn't actually cause that, but it started the conversation that, almost 10 years later would eventually give us that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I talking about seeing that film, because it is a very suspenseful film. Really, the entire time you're in suspense, as well as in the book, you have this feeling of suspense. And while we were watching it, there were some under, 13 children, and they were talking about their beach trip and the sharks. And so I can definitely see how this movie, even though it was made in the 70s, still it has that same fear aspect that it had back then.
So you want to talk about the book for just a moment then?
Absolutely. Yeah. With the book, my favorite part personally about the novel is the characterization and the character development. I really enjoy hearing the characters' backstories. And one thing that I love about the novel that we don't get a lot in the film is this class idea of islanders and then, the outsiders. I think that islander community is just very prevalent in the book. And the islanders treat all those who come visit, all the tourists, very differently. And that idea of class is just really interesting to me.
Yeah, and there's even a line where Hooper and Quint meet each other in the film, and they're kind of arguing, and Hooper's, he says something about Hooper's soft city hands, and Hooper says, don't give me that working class hero crap. And that made a lot more sense with the book than it did in the film. It kind of took me by surprise to hear that. And then, of course, we've mentioned the affair between Ellen and Hooper that we'll maybe gloss over slightly. It's worth noting that when we did co-teach this book, our class hated Ellen Brody, just irredeemably so. And then, of course, the mafia interactions as well. It's interesting, you know, we'll talk a little about the adaptation, how this got filmed. Actually, the producer, and his name escapes me, but he was married to Helen Gurley Brown, who is the editor of Cosmo, and she had gotten an advanced copy of the book, and of course he saw it, and he's like, this is, I think, 73 before it was published, and he's like, yeah, this is going to be made into a movie. He actually said a little later that if he had read the book a second time, he probably would not have would have bought the rights, because he said he didn't realize how challenging it would be to actually make the film. Of course, they handed it to this young upstart director who just directed a movie called Sugarland Express, and then, of course, was Steven Spielberg, who read the book and loved it as well. Interesting side note, he actually was going to back out at one point, and one of the producers told him, just make Jaws, and you'll be able to make any other film you want to. Truer words, perhaps, were never spoken. It is worth noting, if we talk about the book and the film and some of the differences, one of the reasons is, in an interview with Newsweek, Spielberg mentioned that when he read the book, he was rooting for the fish, kind of wanting them to eat him, all the people. I think he said in alphabetical order.
Yeah.
we were trying to figure out if that was alphabetical order by first name or last name, and why he would want, perhaps, you know, Brody eaten before Hooper. But who knows? I think he was just being kind of cheeky. That does kind of give us some idea of how the script changed. And I do think that's an interesting point in the book, too, that we've talked about. I love the film, particularly for that whole three men on a boat scene in the third act that you're going to talk about. But the one thing that I really enjoy about the book is there's moral ambiguity. Almost no character is a good guy. Mm-hmm. Brody is probably the closest thing we have. And even though he's maybe a purer of heart, he's weak. He's ineffectual. He's scared of water, which they do take over. But I still get the sense that in the film, Brody is competent at his job. And I don't think you get that in the book at all.
Yeah, I think for the film adaptation, for me, there are a lot of big character differences, particularly with Ellen Brody, right? Because like you said, there almost is no clear antagonist in either adaptation, in the novel or the film. But in the novel, every character is antagonistic in some sort of way. Ellen cheats on her husband. She is discontent with her life. And we don't get that in the film at all. She's a very loving, supportive mother and wife. And so I think in the film, I was rooting for the people. I think the first time I watched it, because I thought, how could this shark do this? but then after reading the novel, I was like, yes, I am absolutely rooting for the shark. She didn't do anything wrong. She's just living her life in the ocean. You know, they're recreationally swimming in it. I was rooting for the shark in the novel.
And that's probably a nice segue into our close read. This was not something we had on the script, but when you said she, referring to the shark, that's something worth talking about, because sharks are sexually dimorphic, meaning that there's a notable size difference in one gender out of the two. And of course, that's the female, right? Female sharks are much larger. So if this shark is indeed 25 feet, the way that Hooper tells us, then it has to be a female. You know, there's no shark, no great white has been spotted that's 25 feet to begin with, but if one does exist, it has to be female, which is interesting because in the book, everyone calls it a he. Of course, in the film, they nickname the animatronic shark Bruce. But I even noticed that Hooper, the ichthyologist who should know better, refers to the shark as a he. And I believe both the film and the definitely the novel, I've seen that. So that kind of makes for an interesting read when you take that gender dynamic into play. What does that represent? We could get into a feminist read here, although that's not part of our close read.
Yeah, I think it's, when you think about literary theory, one of the easiest to apply to this novel is eco-criticism or eco-feminism, right? Especially thinking about the shark as female and the mother nature aspect of that, and how the shark is also a predator. And that's something that our characters typically associate in the masculine sense. And so I think it's really interesting to think about those gender dynamics in mother nature, but also mother nature breeds predators, in that masculine and feminine dynamic that our characters are perpetuating onto the shark.
Maybe that's a good segue for me. So I'm going to take a quick look at a passage in the book, and then Mackenzie is going to look at a passage in the film. And by the way, film studies is weird. We call it a close read for the film as well. Just get used to it. We also call it reading a film, not watching it. So that's the way that we'll be talking throughout this podcast. So I'm going to look at the dinner party, which is another piece that does not exist in the film. There is a part where Hooper comes over and brings some wine. This is a much more antagonistic, particularly with Hooper. So the thing I found interesting, and I have brought this up at a couple of conferences and a couple of presentations I've done on Jaws, the way Hooper is portrayed is very similar to the predatory nature of the shark and the way that the shark is portrayed. And there's a lot of predation going on in this book and a lot of language along those ways, some of it uncomfortable. And we'll just elide over that and let you find it on your own. But it's interesting that, for starters, you mentioned the class warfare and that sort of sense. Hooper is consistently described in the book as sort of preppy, very much intellectual and of a certain class and a certain privilege. And when he shows up to this party, so Ellen decides to host a dinner party. And particularly, she's also worth noting in the book here, she's not an Islander native. She was one of the people who visited. So she comes from that same privilege and, of course, falls in love with this handsome sheriff on the island. Sheriffs don't make a very high pay grade. So she's living a life in a much lower standard than she's used to. And she sees Hooper, whom she actually dated Hooper's brother, right, at one point. And it sort of connects her back to her past and the sort of wealth that she's missing. But also she's feeling the age creeping up on her, right? She's feeling a little bit of her age, not feeling as pretty as she used to be. And, of course, Hooper tells her he had a crush on her when he was little. And in a lot of ways, what she does as a character is reprehensible. And I'm in no way saying, yay, adultery, we're pro-adultery. But her motivations make sense. She's trying to capture that youth. And Hooper sees that, and he immediately moves in on it. Mm-hmm. So speaking of that upper class part of Hooper, we're told he wears, this is from page 133 of the edition we're working out of, which is Ballantine, I guess. The Ballantine book, in case anybody's curious. Also, we're scholars by trade, so we have to cite our sources. He wears bell-bottom blue jeans, Ouijian loafers with no socks, and a red Lacoste shirt with an alligator on the breast. It was the uniform of the young and rich in Amity. So it sets him apart in a lot of ways with his wealth and his privilege, but also that alligator, I think, is very key. And it's mentioned in another part of the book as well, on someone's shirt. Another sign of a predator, and particularly an aquatic predator. But what becomes really interesting is the way Ellen dresses, right? We're told that she wears a string of cultured pearls that Brody had given her as a wedding gift. And when Hooper comes in, he brings a gift for the hostess, as is common, but it's a shark tooth, right? A tiger shark tooth. And Ellen gets excited, asks Brody to run and get the silver chain that she has in her bedroom. And of course, she affixes the shark tooth and asks Matt to put it on her. And at the same time, she kind of flippantly tosses the pearls aside, right? And Brody has to take them and put them in his pocket. So again, that shark tooth very much represents that predatory nature of Hooper. And we're, of course, going to find out in what the next chapter that the two of them will engage upon that affair that we've been talking about. Brody senses it. I'm going to read a quote from this as well. It's from page 135. Brody felt threatened, as if an intruder had come into his home, possessing the subtle, intangible weapons he could not cope with, looks and youth and sophistication, and above all, a communion with Ellen born at a time which Brody knew Ellen wished had never ended. So again, a little piece of echo criticism there, the blending of the natural predator in the shark with this representation of Hooper as a predator as well.
Yeah, I think this is another one of those examples where in the film, it's just so different, the characterization of Hooper, because he comes in as a helper in the film. And then in the book, we constantly get this vernacular that describes him in a very menacing way as an intruder, like an intruder in this home space, an intruder on the island, because he also dislikes how he's treated so differently by the islanders. And so then that makes me question, when you corner a predator, do you expect it not to attack, in a sense? You know, he feels very attacked himself. And so I try to empathize with him as much as possible. I try to empathize with each character, but he just, he walks into this home, he flirts with her, he really is an intruder, and he has no regard for Brody as a sheriff, as a husband, as a father, as anything.
Yeah, and it's worth noting another difference, because Brody suspects, right? He's a cop, he's used to this kind of stuff. He's trying to kind of get to the bottom of it, but more worried about the shark, and in the end, Hooper goes down in that shark cage and, unlike the film, perishes. So kind of a moot point. he's paddling back on his own at the end of it. So do we want to turn it over to you then and tackle the film?
Yeah, absolutely. So in my close read of the film, I chose the scene that's commonly referred to as the scar scene. This is where the several men that we see in the boat, which are Brody, Quint, and Hooper, they are on their first night out on the voyage. They're in the cabin eating dinner. And one imagery aspect that I just find really interesting is these men are eating steak, right? A typically masculine meal. And Brody's steak is untouched, while Hooper's and Quint's are entirely eaten. And so I think that's just a little interesting. That also goes into Brody's actions in the latter of this scene. And the cinematography of this scene is a very dark surrounding with a single light in the very middle of the scene that briefly swings to Hooper and then briefly swings to Quint as well. And both their faces are kind of lighted when they're speaking. And I thought that was just a very interesting choice that really makes you focus on the facial expressions and even the words that the characters are speaking in that moment. And Quint really begins this scar scene with this idea of permanence. He says, "You want to feel something permanent," or "You want to see something permanent." And he immediately goes to his scars. And so there's this idea of permanence that we associate with scars. And I was thinking, why is it that our first acquaintance with permanence is pain? Like, why is pain one of the first things we think of in a permanent sense? And maybe it's because scars are that visual symbol of emotion and experience. Because I can look at someone and see a scar and think, well, maybe that was from some physical battle of some sort. But I can't really see your joy in that sense outside of a smile or an eyebrow lift or something like that. But scars are with you on your skin forever. And so this framing of the table being in the center. And while Quint and Hooper, they don't typically get along. And that's a lot to do with the class that we're talking about. You know, Quint has a lot of his experience from adventures, personal expeditions. A lot of Hooper's experience comes from his education. And Quint and Hooper just really butt heads in that sense on what's the right thing to do. And they're around this table in this scar scene, and it makes you think of a family dynamic because we oftentimes consider mealtime to be a sort of sacred time. And so I think that's really interesting that the only time they seem to get along is this dinner table when they're talking about their pain and their scars. And so while Hooper and Quint have these physical scars, Brody's scar is more internal. It's this fear of this water, this fear of failure. And we see this because while they're showing off their scars, Brody's in the corner. He hasn't touched his steak. He feels separate, and he kind of dwells on that. You know, he briefly lifts his shirt up to look at a small scar that we don't really know what that's from. There's nothing about that in the novel or in the film. And so he briefly looks down, he looks back up, looks at his comrades that he feels so distant from, and decides not to share whatever story he was considering. And so he's distant in this entire camaraderie of, here's my scar, my adventure, my struggle. And Quint's tales of his scars are very physical in nature. He talks about celebrating his wife's demise and bar fights and arm wrestling and just very physical encounters. And Hooper, most of his stories are technical, more so in nature. He was out on an expedition with some of his classmates, got bitten by a shark, right? It's very contained violence, while Quint is just off the rails. Like super crazy stories that are very fascinating, but it also contributes to that difference in experience that they bring into their prejudices against each other. And so there's this huge mix of emotional severity, but also drunken comedy.
Well, you know my favorite line. Mary Ellen Moffitt.
Mary Ellen Moffitt.
She broke my heart.
She broke my heart. And that's really the only emotional scar that's referenced is Hooper saying, you know, I've got you all beat, a broken heart, right? That's the most intense scar that one can have. And that emotional severity is overshadowed then by everyone's drunk and everyone's laughing because that was semi-funny, even though it's not. And I think that Brody laughs at that point, too, because that is the moment where Brody does relate in a little bit of a sense where it's an internal struggle. And so I just wonder, why doesn't Brody join in on the camaraderie? Like, sometimes it's easy to think that he just puts himself in isolation. Like, he doesn't attempt sometimes to join in. And I'm not sure where that fear stems from. Maybe it's being in the position of power as the sheriff. Maybe he feels like he's the father of the town. He has to protect it, so he feels like he can't get close with these individuals. I'm not sure why he self-imposes his isolation.
I think part of it, too, is just to continue to put that idea forth that he's out of his element. Mm-hmm. He's the opposite of a fish out of water, right? Because he hates water. And here he is on the boat and also, you know, whether it's Clint or Hooper, they both have knowledge of the sea and of the wildlife there in different aspects and from different perspectives. But Brody has none of that, right? Mm-hmm. Brody is completely out of his element. So I think he feels isolated on that boat to begin with. And that just further puts him apart. And then the moment they all do start singing, "Show me the way to go home," and kind of come together, of course, the dang shark's got to go and pop her head up again, right?
Right. Right, and in the film, I think of, you know, I want Brody to join in. I kind of want him to have this friendship. But in the book, it's also noteworthy that Hooper had made a very sly comment on the boat, alluding to an affair with Ellen. And so in the book, I totally understand why Brody is super, I don't want to, standoffish, for lack of the term I'm
surly.
Searching. Yeah, very surly. He just... I understand why he doesn't want to be near Hooper at all in the book.
Yeah, because he's pretty much all but convinced
yeah.
that this has happened. And of course, he's right. He should trust his instincts there. It's probably also worth noting that there may be some residual, right? Because this was written, Benchley did the screenplay, and I think he did 4 rewrites. Mm-hmm. And then they turned it over to Carl Gottlieb to continue to do the script. So, you know, who knows what some of those early drafts were, and some of that stuff sometimes survives for that reason as well. But. Right. Either way, it does make for some great pondering of why these dynamics are the way they are. And some stuff we'll never know. Some stuff you've got to fill in just with your imagination.
In the film, they end up being friends. I mean, really, at the end.
Yeah.
You know, but in the book, he gets what's coming, Hooper, you know.
I don't know if I'd go that far. But so shall we pause for a minute? Before we move on to our next category, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor, Amity Island.
Looking for the perfect summer getaway? Look no further than Amity Island, the picturesque resort town with a history as rich as its stunning beaches. Sure, we might be famous for a certain great white encounter from the 70s, but that's all water under the bridge now. Our beautiful island has been absolutely shark-free for decades, so you can swim, surf, and sunbathe without a worry in the world.
Amity Island is more than just its beaches. Enjoy fresh seafood at Quint's Grill, where the catch of the day is never you. Dive into history at the Brody Maritime Museum and take a scenic boat tour around the island. Just don't ask our captain to show you his scar collection. Whether you're here for the 4th of July festivities or for a relaxing weekend escape, Amity Island welcomes you with open arms.
So pack your bags, bring your family, and come experience the charm, the adventure, and the peace of Amity Island. Book your trip today and discover what Amity is a vacation you'll never forget, for all the right reasons.
Amity Island. Just when you thought it was safe to have the best summer ever. Yeah. Incidentally, we're never going to stop making nautical puns on this podcast. It's
absolutely no way. Yes.
Both of us are psychologically and I think physiologically incapacitated to do so. We just can't stop ourselves.
If there is an opportunity to make a pun, you have to take it. It like comes along with being in the English community.
I think it's written in the Bible, but... All right, so shall we move on to some of our smaller segments?
Yes, most hated character.
I am
excited.
Okay, so what we're going to do here, there are some obvious answers to each of these that I think most people would agree with, but we're going to maybe try to approach it from some sideways perspectives as well, and maybe bring in some ideas that are not so popular. Mm-hmm. I know I've got a hot take coming up.
Right.
But let's go ahead and get it out of the way. Larry Vaughn.
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, one of the favorite things I love about literature overall is that there's almost no, you know, right answer. Everything's up to your analysis, interpretation. But Larry Vaughn is just not a good person, especially in the novel. You know, in the film, we get him briefly compared to the novel, because in the novel, he's indebted to the mafia.
Right.
Like, he owes the mafia so much money, and he's exploiting the townspeople. He needs to raise this money to pay off his debts. And that's just so...
Because at least in the film, he's got the town's best interest at heart, right?
Right.
Economic, you know, the bottom line they have to make for the summer to survive. And it's not so much that in the film as it is, I've got to pay these, you know, these mafia guys off. Cascada, mm-hmm. I believe it is, the sort of conglomeration that's controlled by the mafia. There's, of course, a slight bit of sympathy, I guess, in the novel that we don't have in the film.
I sympathize with him a little on his wife's condition. And, you know, he really obviously cares for his wife and wants her to get better. And he doesn't want her to know about these bad dealings that he's had. And so I respect his love for his wife. I just wish that he would provide some of that selflessness to the people he's supposed to protect.
And maybe some backdoor commentary on the American healthcare system all the way back in the 70s before we got Breaking Bad.
It's true.
Go ahead. You've got another I know that you want to discuss.
So when we taught this together, as Stephen mentioned earlier, the students absolutely detested Ellen Brody.
Hated her.
I mean, tore her apart. We had one single student that had a sliver of sympathy.
And that was, by the way, secret ballot on that vote. So
yes.
I think she only said that because she knew her name would never be revealed.
And... you know, I have to agree, in the novel, I dislike her very much. In the very beginning, before we get a lot of her internal monologue, I try to sympathize with her position of feeling like her husband's away a good bit. She's fallen into this monotony. She doesn't have anything new in her life that she feels she can have adventure in. But it doesn't excuse any of her actions to, one, have an affair on her husband, but also... doesn't really consider her children very much in the picture either until she feels guilt from the affair. And she seeks all this adventure, but she's hurting the people that she loves the most in the process. And so I just strongly dislike her in the novel. She also never admits to it, and I have a problem with that.
Again, I don't know if I can blame her for that. Again, I'm... anti-adultery. Please don't take this the wrong way. I get her motivations. I see why she did what she did. We as humans make bad decisions. I don't know that I'm going to really blame her for not fessing up because, I mean, Hooper's dead. Now you got away with it.
True.
So, ready for my hot take then?
Yeah, Stephen has a real hot take.
I'm not saying it's the most hated. I just don't like Brody, period. And this is particularly the novel. In the film, he's fine. I don't love him in the film either, but... he's, I think, very deliberately played is so ineffectual. You know, in a lot of ways, a lot of these types of narratives that deal with animal attacks, the human side, you see a lot of these ideas of parenting or protecting young, you know, in a very similar way that you do with the animals. And Brody's just completely unable to protect his family in a lot of ways. Certainly, I don't want to say keep his wife in check, but his wife does go out and have an affair with him, which... again, in the 70s, I'm sure was much more of a symbol of that sort of masculine weakness there. But as a sheriff, he's sort of the surrogate father for the entire community, and he's completely unable to protect. And again, it's the Kitchener boy, right? No, Alex, one of the kids who mm-hmm. winds up dying, as well as I guess you could make the case for Chrissy as well, right? Who was young, still young-ish, old enough to know better, but still technically a child. He's just, I get why, the narrative complexity, and I like that. I just, as a protagonist, I don't like him. I wouldn't want to be friends with him. Just put it that way.
Yeah, so, I...
cue the hate mail.
It is so hard to point, though, any antagonist or protagonist in this novel, which is part of the reason I enjoy it so much, is because there's so much realness in the characterization and the ambiguity of their morals and ethics. But I do appreciate his heart of gold. Like, he does have the right intention. You know, but I don't know. I guess one of the hardest parts in the film really is wondering, could he have done anything at the first time he brought it up to the mayor?
In the film?
Yes, in the film.
I guess he could have gone over the mayor's head and defied him, but and that's even focused more in the book, right? Mm-hmm. He's, you know, threatened to be fired if he doesn't go through with some of this stuff. And again, I get his motivations. You just we're primed to see those scrappy underdogs who stand up to authority and say, "I don't care if I lose my job. Who cares? He's got three kids in the novel. I know the difference." I don't know. I guess I'll cut him some slack. He just he annoys me sometimes. Like, dude, learn to swim. Stop being afraid of water.
Yeah, if you're gonna live on an island, you should probably learn.
Oh, that great line from the film. It's only an island if you look at it from the outside. So shall we move into our academia-style version of this game?
Yes. Yes, we should.
All right. So enjoy, teach, scholarship. And I do have to give credit to someone we both know to some degree from the University of Troy, Dr. Kurt Kernut. He's the one who actually put this idea out for me. But he said anytime he comes across a film or a book, he asks himself three questions. Number one, did I enjoy it? Did it entertain me? Number two, could I teach this? Is there any way I could bring this and integrate it into a class? And then number three, is there any scholarship I can do on it? Is there anything maybe, is there a paper? Is there a conference presentation here? So because I deal with both film and literature, these are the kind of questions I ask myself as well now that I come across in any kind of literature or book that I sit down with. And that's important too, because sometimes when I start watching a film, it feels like work. So that's important that we keep the enjoy at the very top. So you want to go ahead and start out with the enjoy part?
Yes, I really enjoyed reading the book. Again, I saw the movie for the first time, you know, in adolescence and really enjoyed it. But then reading the novel, and I just love the complexity of it. I really enjoy both in two very different ways. I love the colors and the costume design and the actors and actresses in the film. I thought they did a fantastic job. It's so easy to watch, in a sense of you're engaged the whole time. And so I really enjoy watching the film. And I enjoy reading the book because of the complexity of the characters. And I can't imagine how difficult it must have been in the 70s to create that mechanical shark.
Well, apparently pretty difficult because it didn't work.
And so I really enjoy that in the film, too. I think the shark is very well done. I didn't think at all it was any kind of cheesy or they used it too much. Like, I really enjoy it.
I'm going to have to disagree with you there. The shark is horrible. But that is a very interesting point that you bring up. The shark looks so bad. Matter of fact, Spielberg said at one point, what was it, a 26-foot turd gliding through the water is what it looked like. But it was so bad they had to actually change the way they filmed it. So they did a lot from the shark's point of view and a lot of underwater shots. And I think that's what makes the film so memorable. You know, that famous, you're going to need a bigger boat line is really the first time we see the shark when it pops its head up. And it is shocking. And yeah, the first time I saw it, I forgot about how bad that shark looked when it popped its head up. But yeah, aside from that, I agree with everything you said, other than that slight disagreement. We will sometimes disagree, I'm sure. It's my favorite film of all time. Period. I know as a film scholar, I should say Fellini or Bergman or at least Scorsese, but nah, it's purely this popcorn munching film because it's got two layers. It is very much that blockbuster creature feature, but parts like that scar scene you're talking about, or the speech right before it with, or after it, I guess, with the USS Indianapolis before. That's just so amazing. Mm-hmm. So well done. And it brings an extra layer of depth to a film. And I don't know that we get that in our summer blockbusters anymore, do we?
No, you know, it's very timeless. It's been popular for decades now. It's still shown various times across the summers everywhere.
Two Saturdays ago here in this town on the big screen. By the way, if you get a chance, see it on the big screen. So much I saw that I've missed after all those viewings. So teach. we literally taught it. So I think this one's a pretty easy one. I think it went well. It's worth noting these were honors students, but they enjoyed it. A couple of them, we had it assigned over spring break because we're mean like that. And a couple of them did take it to the beach to read, and that made for some interesting discussions. But they did seem to enjoy it. How could you not enjoy something with a shark? But they got into the sort of the interpersonal drama quite a bit as well. Yes. We mentioned Ellen Brody, but there was a lot more than just that.
Yes, they were extremely, I think, engrossed in talking about, I think, a novel particularly, they just don't get a lot of anymore, especially at the college level. And so I think they really enjoyed reading and discussing a novel because they were able to become so engrossed in it. And one of my favorite things about teaching it was that we got to teach the nuances in the book, the symbolism, and like the shark being female because of its size. Like, that's something that if you watch the film, you wouldn't really get. But when you do the research in the novel and teaching it, you're able to share that with the students.
You really ran with that.
Yes.
Did a good job with it.
I loved it. I loved learning that. And, of course, you know, Stephen taught me that because his specialty is in animal attack fiction. So he had the most wonderful insights into Jaws. And I'm
basically a marine biologist. I'm kidding. I'm not George Costanza.
But yeah, I did. I thought teaching it was very successful and it was a lot of fun for both teachers and students. It was, I think, a very rapport building book and lesson.
I would agree.
Mm-hmm. And then in scholarship, yeah, I think there is a lot of opportunities for scholarship here. Again, the most obvious being, as mentioned earlier, an ecofeminism, eco-criticism approach. But I would even challenge a potential psychoanalysis of the brief parts where we get the shark's point of view. That was also one of my favorite parts about reading the novel, was getting that shark point of view. So interesting. But, of course, I'm not the expert. Stephen is an expert.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, you mentioned that, and you said psychoanalysis. One of the few actual academic pieces that is picking apart the book is a psychoanalytic reading, and we were going to try to keep the show G-rated, so I'm not going to get into some of the psychoanalysis, but aside from that, you see very little, aside from stuff that some guy named Stephen has done here and there. Yeah, I agree, it's wide open. Certainly the eco-criticism angle. Interestingly enough, what you're talking about is animal studies, which is an offshoot of eco-criticism and eco-feminism, which it's wide open, and it gets poo-pooed, I guess, sometimes for being non-serious literature, but I think we're at a point now in literary studies where we don't care. I mean, I'm also doing studies on things like Sharknado. Do I think Sharknado is a good film? Absolutely not. It's terrible, although entertaining, sure. But it doesn't have to be good to be worthy of study, and this just happens to, I think, be kind of good as well, so...
Yeah, absolutely.
You budding scholars, come on.
Yes. Yes, like, who are we to judge what's going to stand the test of time? Why not explore all of it and have fun? You know?
Yeah, and what better than sharks?
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of having fun, the WTF moment. This has to come from the book. Go ahead. I'm just going to let you run wild with it.
Yeah, it's definitely the entire... very sensual chapter in the book that describes Cooper and Ellen's affair. It is way too long of a section. It is way too graphic.
It's almost like a mini romantic comedy when they're at the at the dinner, but then it just turns into softcore pornography. I mean, it's pretty wild.
It's a very, definitely has the shock factor, because I was not expecting it, and it just... You know, I respect this author. It just didn't feel like it fit with everything else.
Yeah. Interesting. I did tell the students, right? Like, it's from page here to here. You can skip it and miss nothing about the book. And I think they all immediately ran to read those pages. I'll talk just a little bit about the history here. And again, this comes from Kurt Kernot, of all people, in his introduction to, it's called Literature in Transition, the 1970 to 1979. So he writes a little bit about the 70s and some of the trends in literature in this introduction. And he mentions a Supreme Court case from 1966 called Memoirs versus Massachusetts. Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure, also called Fanny Hill. If you're curious, that was the book this shop was selling. And by the way, if you read it, hilarious. I think it's from the 16th century. It's definitely NSFW, but it's satire. It's pretty well done. And the Supreme Court ruled essentially that pornography could be banned, but it had to solely appeal to the prurient interest and have no redeeming social value. So we know this. You can make a case that anything. I could give you the instruction manual for your microwave and make a case that it has some sort of artistic value or social value to it. So it basically just opened the door and said, you can't ban anything from being sold. Well, publishers, of course, knowing sex sells, started encouraging their writers and publishing stuff that got more and more risque, shall we say, right? Portnoy's Complaint by Philip Roth comes out around that time. Fear of Flying, Erica mm-hmm. Jong. So I don't know for sure, but it almost seems like Benchley either said, hey, I've got to do this because everybody's doing it, and just sort of shoehorned an incredibly explicit scene, or it may have been the editor was like, hey, you know, we need some TNA in this thing, so here, go rewrite it and put something in it. Either way, you're right, it does feel so out of place, and we didn't even get to the whole car wreck fantasy thing that, again, we'll just go read the book if you want to read it.
If you read the novel, you'll know exactly where it is. You'll know exactly where the scene is.
So, WTF. The other side of that, let's geek out a little bit. So, the scene that is taught in film school, the one that just consistently is referred to, there's a scene, this is when Alex Kitchener is being attacked by the shark, right? So, Brody's on the beach is open, he's already kind of nervous, and you see him sitting in the chair, Ellen's behind him, and when the kid screams, when we know there's a shark in the water, there's this very infamous sort of zoom that's done very, very interestingly. It's called the dolly zoom. That's its technical term. It's also sometimes called the Jaws shot or the vertigo effect, which is Hitchcock sort of made this popular. I'm just going to read the description from a site called Film School Rejects, which if you need any kind of technical expertise on some of this, the camera work and things like that, that's a great website to go to. They say dolly zooms are an in-camera illusion achieved by combining a wide-angle zoom lens, a steady zoom, and a dolly. By dollying and zooming in opposite directions, the foreground elements appear to stay the same size while the background appears to squeeze or stretch. So essentially what you're doing, a dolly is just like a, almost like a railroad kind of, and you've got this track where the camera is sitting, and you can roll back and forth. So you're zooming in as you're rolling back or vice versa. And what that allows it to do is you're still focused on that one subject, in this case, Brody, and we pull back and it expands across the beach. And it creates a sense of either like disturbance or sort of a disorientation. Again, Vertigo, I think, is a good example if you're familiar with that film. When forget the main character's name, Jimmy Stewart's character, when he looks down as he's climbing the bell tower and the stairs just get longer and longer, that's a great shot of that. Scorsese loves it. Goodfellas, the diner scene with De Niro and Ray Liotta. Raging Bull, really great scene in that. Pulp Fiction, it's one of my favorite dolly zooms. It's when Mia is doing a line of cocaine and she ODs. And when she first she takes that hit and you kind of see her fall back, there's a really interesting dolly zoom there. My other kind of all-time favorite comes from John Landis, Michael Jackson's Thriller. Right, we've got a really great scene when he first transforms in that. You get an interesting piece of dolly zoom as well. So this is by far not the first dolly zoom. And you could make the argument that Vertigo is the most famous of the bunch. But if it's not the most famous, it is by far the second most famous dolly zoom. And I don't know what you think about it, but I always totally geek out when I see it. And seeing it on the big screen the other night was...
Yeah, seeing it on the big screen was... different. It's very eye-catching, very engrossing for the viewer as well. And after the film, we were talking with our other colleague who went as well.
Also a film scholar.
Yes. We were discussing overall how the framing of the shots, it seemed to be heavier on one side than the other for majority of the film. And that was really interesting to discuss as well, because I had never watched it intentionally looking for those things until we went and saw it.
It's an incredibly asymmetrical film and a lot of threes. You get, of course, mm-hmm. Three Men on the Boat, but there were points with like Hooper, Larry Vaughn, and Brody all together. And they're all kind of staged in those shots, I think, very, very interestingly.
Yeah.
It's very masterfully done. Can I make another hot take?
Yes.
Jaws is my favorite film. Another one of my favorites is Jurassic Park, Animal Attacks. So you'd think I'm like a Spielbergaholic. I really don't like most of Spielberg. I won't say don't like. I don't rave and rant and salivate over him the way that some people do. I like the Indiana Jones stuff, E.T., take it, leave it, Close Encounters, it was all right. I don't like Saving Private Ryan past the Normandy scene. Just, I don't know. I said it was unbelievable, but then I found it was actually loosely based on a true story. But yeah, Spielberg, he kind of gets schmaltzy sometimes and a little bit overly preachy, I think, and I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of him, and that's more of the storytelling. The one thing that I will give Spielberg a thumbs up to is his filmmaking and his eye for some of those shots. He's very talented with that.
Because there were multiple instances of zooming in the film that, again, I had never paid attention to until I was intentionally looking for it this time around. But then I think about how my subconsciously that had has impacted me in watching it in the past, and how those little things that these directors decide to do really affect the feeling you get from watching it.
Yeah, it's almost like that's why we have film scholars to point this stuff out. No, you're right, though. That stuff subconsciously affects us, and you don't realize it. And, you know, before you started looking to film, I know before I did, right? You're just like, wow, I knew I felt that way, but now I know why. And that's it's kind of an interesting revelation
when
you get that. So maybe we can impart that to some of the listeners, I hope.
Yes, because I'm very new to the film studies realm, got a lot to learn, really enjoying learning. And I highly encourage you to just look up some of the vocabulary, you know, some of the terminology that you might want to know from film studies. And the next time you're watching a film, looking for that. It's just very enriching as a viewer.
Mise en scène.
And say mise en scène.
Yeah. All you got to do is say that and you're a film scholar. It's just guaranteed. So shall we move on to our final thoughts?
Yep. My final thoughts are just, I love them both. I love the novel. I love the film in two very different ways. And I think it's so universal in the enjoying teaching and scholarship that we discussed earlier. I think it's a very universal book.
It has stood the test of time. And, you know, even for people who haven't seen it, they'll recognize that iconic theme that we haven't talked about yet. They know it's about a shark, right? They've probably seen clips of it. I mean, for a while there, I think TNT played it every day, at least once. And I don't think it's going away. I mean, it's, and you'll vouch from here, it's kind of hard to keep connected with the students nowadays because the stuff we talk about, they're just like, yeah, I don't know what that is. That's for old people like me. But this is one of those, I think, one of those few touchstones that you can still say, hey, Jaws, and students recognize it. And many of them have even seen it. You know, maybe not read it, but have seen it. I will say this. I will like any film or story better, probably 25% better, if you include sharks, dinosaurs, or ninjas.
Entirely fair.
Yeah.
Yep.
By the way, somebody needs to make that film, Sharks versus Dinosaurs versus Ninjas. I will watch that in a heartbeat. I will say this about, the film is my favorite film of all time, as I've said. I love the book. I agree. Pacing, characterization, plotting in general are brilliant. Very well done in the book. I don't think Benchley is a good writer as far as his prose. It's a little flat. I think he tries to be Hemingway, and only Hemingway can be Hemingway. But aside from that, it's a minor critique. You know, most writers from this time period are a little bit flat and dull when it comes to that as well. So he's no poet. Big deal. Read the book. You'll still enjoy it.
Yes, highly recommend reading it. Well, thank you for plumbing the depths of this very special book and film combo with us. We hope you found something to sink your teeth into. And thanks for joining us on the maiden voyage of Real Lit with Mackenzie and Steven. If you liked what you heard, please join our social media sites. You can find us on Facebook by searching Real Lit Podcast, Instagram at Real Lit Podcast with no spaces, and our official website, reallitpodcast.com. And remember that that's real, R-E-E-L, like the film reel. And finally, do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button so you can be alerted each time a new episode drops. And speaking of new episodes, coming next from Lois Duncan's 1973 novel that captivated Gen Xers.
Yay, that's me.
To the 1997 film filled with the hottest young stars that captivated millennials. We delve into urban legends, hook hands, and those foolish teenage years. So be sure to tune in. This episode of Real Lit was produced by Reagan Babb, and our theme music was composed by Eric and Elise Collier. Special thanks to this episode's ichthyological consultant, Dr. Matt Hooper. Smart guy, just keep him away from your wife. For Real Lit, we're your hosts, Mackenzie and Steven. And until next time, keep both the reels and the pages turning.